patty cake. I'm the baker's man. I bake them cakes as fast as I can. And you can tell by how my bread stack up. Then disguise it as rap so the feds back up. Watch it like my whip, like my chick topless. Doing a buck six with me in the cockpit. Grinding cousin, I got holes for a dozen. Even 11.5 if I see you keep it coming. And my weight, that's just as heavy as my name. So much dough, I can't swear I won't change.
I'm John.
And I'm Ash.
And this is You're Damn Right. We talk about the week in TV, specifically the most important, most conversation-worthy shows. Guys, leave us a comment, like, share, subscribe. Thanksgiving just passed. We're recording this on a Friday, right after Thanksgiving in America. We are thankful for the support we've received, for the listeners we've given, or that we have, that you are giving, the listens you are giving us, and we're very thankful. All right, Ash, I don't want to subvert order here. I don't want to change anything up. We will restructure at some point, but for now, let's just go the way we have been, and so that means we start with Scream Queens. What did you think about, this episode was called Thanksgiving, so appropriate.
I actually liked this one. It was pretty good. It was better than the last, some of the past episodes. This one was actually pretty good.
I think this is the best episode. At least, very least since the pilot, maybe altogether. And first of all, poor Chanel 3, I felt so bad for Chanel 3. Even though, like, the Thanksgiving setup they had was pretty amazing in her house with all the recliners, and they all just sat there and watched football with their frozen food, I understand why she wants Charles Manson to be her father, because he would be better than her real father.
Terrible.
Everybody has shitty families, but for some reason, and it might just be because... I'm sorry, like, Chanel 1, Chanel 3 has become my favorite character on the show. Like, just all of the little things Billy Lord does is amazing. Like, when Dean Munch decided, okay, I'm now convinced you, Wingnut number 3, are not the killer. She just, like, she's in the middle of eating, and she just, like, raises her glass, like, yeah, what's up? She does so many little things that... I don't know if they're being directed or she's just doing them, but I love them all. But anyway, I actually felt sympathy for a character, Ash, on Scream Queens. I felt actually bad for somebody.
Yo, those meals was fucking terrible. I was like, oh my, I would have left too. And that was just terrible.
It was over the top, but since everything on Scream Queens is over the top, it didn't bother me. And I just love thinking, like... Poor Chanel, what did she do? Like, how could you not love her and her earmuffs? What the fuck?
Earmuffs. Well, I would say the only two things I thought was kind of, well, not disappointed, but I kind of wanted to see. I wouldn't mind if Denise was there, considering she's kind of part of this fucked up family too now. So I kind of wish she was at the dinner, but... I was fine
without Denise, because I love Denise, the security guard. I'm out on Denise, the house mother. Like, I have no interest in her. Like, just go away.
But I was actually thinking, I was hoping we were going to actually meet Zayda, because I remember Zayda was supposed to be taking Grace back to Oakland to meet her grandma. I wanted to meet her grandmother. I was excited.
Poor Ash.
Grandmother who sends chainsaws and shit to a granddaughter. I wanted to meet this lady.
That's a good point. I do want to meet the woman who sends chainsaws. And who somehow gets that in through the mail. Like, what are you sending today? Yes. Oh, it's a chainsaw. Don't worry about it. How did you feel about the Radwells?
They realize Chad may be the sanest one in the family.
Here's the bizarre thing. We met all these families except for Zayday's, which, you know, you're right. That's a good call by you. Zayday's grandma definitely should have been around, but meeting all the families, here's what's the most fucked up thing, Ash. I think the Radwells are the most functional one. They at least seem to care about each other and get along. Like, they might be fucked up people, but they actually function as a family.
Yeah.
They had some star power. Like, shout out to Alan Thicke and Chad Michael Murray there. Like, they had some people I knew. They are, like, such legit terrible people, though, that Chanel actually had to be, like, the moral voice of reason. Like, when Chanel stands up and is like, you're a terrible person, then you're a terrible person.
Yeah, then that's how you know you ain't shit. Like, they were shitting on her hard this episode, too. I was like, damn.
And they called her a gold digger at one time. Like, she is gross rich, Ash. She is super gross rich. She does not need money.
Oh, man.
You remember when she bought off those security guards for, like, the Duchess of whoever? Like, I think she's got enough money, okay? She played no... Like, when she threatened to strangle the mother, like, it's good to know that she will strangle a bitch across the table. Like, that was
great. That was funny. I laughed my ass off when she jumped up so quick to get that bitch. I was like, oh, shit.
What she said was, like, you're lucky you're so far away, but which really, like, indicated to me, like, I would strangle you, but I don't want to you put in the effort to walk across the table.
This was a really good episode. I actually really liked it.
It was. It functioned well structurally because it did two things. It showed us where some of these people come from, and it gave us reasons why they're all such terrible people. Like, and the whole, like, scene where Dean Munch sets everything up, it was a really good plot device because it allowed each character to, like, postulate theories on the killer, thereby giving the audience theories for each suspect, and it was just a really well-used plot device to, like, break down the episode, and it did two things. It introduced us to people. We actually got some background on some characters without pure exposition, and we have more suspects or more clues for suspects. Yeah. So who is the killer, Ash?
I actually don't know. I really don't know. It probably wanted to, because I was thinking, like, it's got to be one of the girls, because... You know, the boy was killed. The son was killed last episode, so it's got to be the twin sister. So I don't know who the twin sister is, though.
I mean, it seems too obvious, but I just feel like Grace's father is involved somehow. Like, the guy had, like, a fetish for chainsaws. He moves to campus, and there are a rash of chainsaw murders. He was, I mean, there's just... the fact that if he is somehow not involved, the fact that there is such overwhelming evidence in favor of him being directly involved is bewildering. Just like, if he is not involved, they've just been fucking with the audience, which would not surprise me at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. That seems like typical Ryan Murphy behavior. One thing I did not like, I don't understand, like, Chanel number 5 is suddenly an expert on all things related to spam. None of these girls know anything. They don't know shit. And it really bothers Dean Munch if you don't know the difference between then and then. But none of them know anything. But they do know random and very specific things that help the investigation, always. Like, one of them just happens to know, like, why people are allergic to deli meats. Of course they do.
Yeah, that was weird.
It's not that. That was like the most recent example. That's something that's sort of been going on all season. Just like somebody's like, "Oh, but let me drop this random knowledge, even though I've been portrayed as a complete idiot. I know something very specific about this." But anyway, I did like this episode a lot. It's still not. It's not going to be a contender for, like, you know, an Emmy or any awards for me, but it is if it focuses on the girls, like I've been saying, not on the extemporaneous care, and it stays to those to the Chanels, it's going to be a better show. And I like Denise Hetfield too, but I'm not sad if she's not around anymore because I don't really need her trying to be Chanel. That's just weird. It's not funny. It's just it's just weird.
It's really sad. I'm a security Denise. She was awesome.
All right. So, do you have anything else for Scream Queens?
No.
All right. Well, next up, we will talk about Empire. Stay with us. What did you think about Empire this week, Ash? Ooh, that was not a happy noise. You did not like Empire this week. This is going to be good because I thought it got back on track. Tell me what you didn't like.
I don't like what they're doing to Anika.
Okay, I don't like that at all. That was a minor part of the story, so it's not like my big takeaway. But I will continue to reiterate, not only Anika, but Rhonda. I do not like what's happened to either of those characters. Rhonda was like the boss of that house in season one. She was like this manipulative, scheming person who was almost like on Lucius's level. And now, like, all she's there for is, like, to tell you about cutting off girls' ponytails when they flirt with your boyfriend. Like, shaming women instead of, like, addressing your boyfriend. I mean, that's fucked up. And Anika is just, like, some obsessed fangirl now. So even though I did like this episode, I think there was some really good stuff. I really don't like what's happened to Anika, and I don't like what's happening to Rhonda either.
Yeah. It was weird seeing her, like, so happy around Lucius. Because I know she don't like that
much. Well, she does like now. He bought her a fucking house. I'd like anybody who bought me that house.
I know. But it was so weird. Like, I was like, this feels so awkward.
I guess Lucius doesn't even give a shit that, like, his son's half white. Because or his grandson's going to be half white. Like, apparently, Lucius is getting over his racism. He's good now. I think one thing I will say, we need to talk about this episode a little more in depth, but just like a surface thing without talking about any of the actual things that occurred, I thought the use of besides Marissa Tomei, I thought the use of Rosie O'Donnell and Alicia Keys were the best uses of guest roles all season, because all the big stars they brought in this year, it usually is like, oh, here's Chris Rock in a guest star. Here's Neo in a cameo. Watch Luda. These felt like genuine minor characters that just fit into their roles. And I thought they were both really, really good for what they were doing. I mean, neither one of them was asked to do a lot, but apparently Alicia Keys was asked to turn Jamal straight, or at least bi. A little bi curious. What did you think of that? Do you have anything to say on this issue?
Okay, I know a lot of people flipping out about it and everything, but I don't know. Because I was like, please tell me they ain't gonna kiss. Like, that's crazy. You know, I'm all gay as shit. But they're like, it happened. I'm like, oh my gosh, what is happening? But my thing was, I think they just got caught up in the moment. You know, sometimes you kiss people. Shit happens.
That's good enough for me. Like, I don't have a lot to say about it, or I don't find it particularly that interesting, because I'm not that obsessed with what gender people like. But I do, I'll say this, like, Alicia Keys defies gender, right? Like, anybody can fall in love with her. Like, that totally makes sense to me. I got it. Like, you don't need to look at her, watch her, okay, you love her. Got it. This was the first one thing I did.
She was really good in this episode.
She was. One thing I really liked about this episode, though, we've talked about Cookie's evolution this season as somebody who focuses more on business than family, and turning into like a shittier version of Lucius. And this episode sort of addressed that. You know, That it, she was out looking for her sister. She put all her work aside. She was obviously very concerned. I mean, this sort of addressed A, that she had been putting business ahead of family, and B, that she realized that maybe she shouldn't be. That said, I'm an only child, but if a grown-ass woman is out, in crack houses, I'm not gonna go knocking door to door to look for her. That's fucking tough. I got shit to do. I can't take off work for a week to knock on crack houses. That's just me. I'm just speaking. Maybe if I had a sister, I would feel differently, but I don't. So if there's some girl I'm close to, and you become like a fucking crack whore, and then tough. Sorry, you made some shitty decisions.
Shit.
Yeah, Ash. So watch yourself. All right. Don't become a crack whore.
Damn,
Ash. I thought that scene, though, where she sort of was after she found out about her boyfriend, which, by the way, how anticlimactic was that scene, though? I felt like that was going to build to something really big, and it was just sort of over and done with immediately. But,
yeah, it was we don't know what happened to the dude. Lucius probably was like,
I'm guessing Lucius, if Lucius is smart, he had one of the other dudes pull the trigger, but maybe he did it himself.
Yeah.
Then
that killed me. It was Cookie, you ain't do no background check on this motherfucker before you hired him or something.
Yeah, Lucius Googled this dude, and he's oh, I found some shit.
Yeah. background check or something. You just hired this dude you don't know nothing about. most employers do background checks.
But I thought that Tajiri Henson's performance, both throughout this episode, but especially after that happens, and then she has to confront her sister, I thought it was maybe the highlight of the season for me was Tajiri Henson's performance in this episode, Sinned Against. I can't think of a single thing this season that has been better than Tajiri Henson in this episode. So, what you don't like, what I do like specifically is what they did with Cookie's character and Tajiri Henson's performance. Because, let's be clear about why Tajiri gets nominated for an Emmy and nobody else does or anything like that. With a lot of actresses, first of all, some of the actors in the show just aren't that great. But with a lot of actors and actresses, a lot of actresses given this role, this would be a one-note, stereotypical character we would all get old, and we would all get bored of.
Yeah.
She really does a lot with what she's given with Cookie. One thing I really want to discuss with you is something Cookie says in the episode. And it's this confusion of class and race that seems to happen on Empire a lot. And I don't know that I understand it or agree with it. Cookie seems to equate at one point being poor with being black. She tells her sister, you haven't been living in the suburbs with that white man all your life. And I'm just black people live in the suburbs, and some white people live in the slums. Being white and being in the suburbs, or being black and being in the ghetto, are not exclusive things, And they're saying, it seems perpetrating a stereotype against one's own race to make that association. And Lucius has done it. He's basically told Hakeem and Andre and even Jamal, you're not black enough. And it's just what he really means is they didn't grow up in the hood, but that doesn't have anything to do with their skin color. It's ridiculous. So, I'm obviously a white dude, so I will let you address if you agree or disagree or whatever.
No, I agree with you. It's frustrating. Especially, it's hard enough, being, when people get, talked about, being portrayed, you're black here in the ghetto and all this other stuff. And when someone tries to make a come up, trying to get ahead in life, they, get talked down to and looked down upon, you know, people want to get out the fucking hood, and black people live in the suburbs, just like white people live, you know, in the hood.
And yeah, there's a whole show with Anthony Anderson about it. It's funny. You should watch it sometime.
It is a whole show called Shameless of these hot-mess white people who live in the south of Chicago.
Like, apparently, the writers of Empire just need to watch more TV, and TV has clearly taught us everything we know about life. So I just want to point out one other thing I did not like about this episode, and I do think it was a good episode because of what, like, I talked about with Cookie, but, and because of Alicia Keys' performance, but the business discussions are just filler, and it's like, they have a whole scene where Andre presents one thing, and then he goes away for a few days, and he comes back, and he presents a new thing, and he goes away for a couple days, and then Lucius, like, this could be one scene that lasts, like, a minute. Like, basically, you guys are brainstorming and pretending like it took you 3 days to come up with the idea to sell an asset to raise money. Like, that's one of the very first things you should think of. And apparently, I don't know if they're just... This goes back to the season to me being a rush job, because it's filler. They're like, we have 43 minutes to produce this week. We have a 35-minute story. Let's fill 8 minutes of it with Andre and Lucius talking meaningfully about business. It's
like, well, I think the whole point, I agree, though, but I think the whole point is because you know, it's pretty much Lucius's pride, and then his pride gets hit when he goes to the Pepsi commercial shoot, so that, you know, you realize you gotta make some changes and shit in order, because he's clearly at this point pretty jealous of Jamal and his success, even though he wants his kids to be successful, but his own legacy, you know, is kind of like not the shit no more.
Yeah, and that was communicated, but that could have been communicated in like 60 seconds and not in like 8 minutes.
Yeah.
This is way too much time. I like that Lee Daniels just like give himself a cameo though.
I would do that shit though. If I was like a writer or like I have my own show, it's like I would just pop in. Like, and then just walk out.
One more note I have on this episode is when Lucius asks Hakeem, "What do you want?" Hakeem pauses before he goes, "This song can't be bought." And I think he pauses because he doesn't know what he wants. Right? He wants everything. Jamal wants to make good music and express himself. Andre wants his father's approval and connection to be a part of something bigger than himself. Hakeem wants everything. He wants to be Lucius. He wants fame and women and power and money and to be a mogul, as he keeps calling himself. Like, he wants to be Lucius. So there's nothing Lucius can give him that will make him happy, because ultimately, like, he basically wants to take Lucius's place, which Lucius isn't going to give him. And, like...
Yeah, he ain't gonna give
him. You know, so, like, there's nothing... Until Hakeem changes somewhat, because he's still a pretty young guy, he can become less of an idiot as time passes, theoretically. He has been since, like, episode one, but theoretically he could wisen up a little bit. But if we're, like, realistically playing this out, I just see Hakeem, like, not ending particularly well for him, because, like, he can't keep battling, like, his father on this. It's just not gonna... He's trying to fight a war when he doesn't have an army. It's just not gonna work.
Yeah, he's not gonna be Lucius. But I'm hoping, you know, his character, waiting for his character to grow more. But this season, which has been, you know, Hakeem just rejecting, that's pretty much been his main story, just him rejecting his father. So hopefully, you know, we can give him something, and now we got, you know, the
Well, season kid. One was he's a spoiled brat who is mad at his mother over something that's not her fault. Season two is he's a spoiled brat who's mad at his father for being who he is. I thought, as you did, that maybe after he got kidnapped, like, they were really going to explore Hakeem more, and Hakeem would grow from that, and that would be a big character thing. But nothing's really came of that. Other than, you know, we got to kill this dude that Cookie was sleeping with now.
Poor guy.
Poor guy. I don't know. He kind of had it coming.
But it was just like when he came in, it was like giving her a backwards shot.
Yeah, I like how petty he got when he was like he knocked the wine over and he's like, "You got your maid here."
Yes. I'd have been so fucking bad. I would have told his ass, "You owe me another bottle, and you're gonna put his steak cleaner on this rug because that's fucked up."
If
the Aries get red wine out.
If Empire was like a 10 episode seasons and it only concerned itself with like Cookie and Lucius and everyone else were just minor characters, I can't tell you how much better this show would be. I'm not saying it's bad now. I can't tell you how much of an improvement you could be by focusing it on Terrence Howard and Tajiri Henson and cutting out a lot of this extraneous stuff. Because when they're together, yeah, they're really good. Like, every scene with both of them in it is good. I did like Empire, though, and I think next week is the fall finale. Am I right?
I think so.
Oh, so we're gonna have to find some other shit to talk about. But next week, we will be back with Empire.
Right out of shows.
Yeah. We will figure it out. Do not panic, our faithful listeners. Jaleesa, I'm pretty much just talking to you, right? We'll figure it out. All right. Next up, though, we're gonna talk about The Leftovers. Stay with us. So, this week's episode of The Leftovers was both great, in my opinion, and cliched, in my opinion, and fucking insanity, in my opinion. what do you have on International Assassin?
That episode was fucking crazy. That's all I gotta say. Like, that's like the main thing, like... I had to watch it twice, but it was, like, so fucking crazy. It was, Patty was fucking awesome in this episode. Well, grown Patty, the decoy Patty.
She was. Ann Dowd was, I mean, if this was her final episode, I'm sad about it because she's great, but it was a really good way for her to go out.
Yeah, it was done really well. It was a good episode, I think.
It was. I thought it was really smart for them to begin with the answer to our question. We talked about it last week. Like, will they play on, like, the television trope of, is he dead? And I thought they would. But thankfully they did not. Like, right away, here's Kevin. And, he is in water. I think it has to be, the water in Jordan has to be significant, right? It keeps being talked about as super meaningful. Yeah. And, like, people are scooping it out of the lake, and, like, I don't know, it's never been explained why that water is so significant, but in Purgatory, I'm going to call it Purgatory. There's been some debate online of people saying, don't call it Purgatory. I don't care what your Roman Catholic beliefs say Purgatory is. For the purposes of this show, this is basically Purgatory. So, in Purgatory, Kevin is told not to drink the water. Patty says she never touches it. Virgil eventually, like, succumbs to it. He just can't hold out anymore. Holy Wayne loves it. By the way, what's up, Holy Wayne? Glad to see you, buddy. But Kevin keeps getting soaked in the water. Like, he's drowned. Wakes up in a bathtub. He gets thrown in a well. What does the water mean? I have not a fucking clue, Ash. Tell me what the water means.
I have no idea. I don't know. Whenever you kept saying, don't drink the water, I was like...
Okay, so we know that the water is bad for you. We know that Holy Wayne drinks it, but Patty does not. We know that... once Virgil drinks it, he forgets who he is. And we know that Kevin keeps getting covered in it. I'm going to think that it's like some sort of, it's some, like, it's beliefs or, like, mysticism. Like, Patty refuses to accept mysticism. Holy Wayne loves it. Kevin keeps getting... That's my best explanation, because there are a lot... This is so full of symbolism and allegory in this episode, but nothing is more confusing than the water. Patty explained the opening scene of the season, sort of. Did you catch that?
Yeah, I caught that. The second time I watched it, I was like, oh, Kate with the clay glass and everything, yeah.
And she says it became abundantly and cosmically clear that on October 14th, you can lose anyone at any time, and our cave collapsed.
Yeah.
So there was some sort of, like, explicit meaning put into that, like, big metaphorical opening scene. I thought that was really interesting, a really interesting thing to do. I like that we're at least touching on that, because it's still the weirdest opening ever.
I don't know what the fuck happened.
But,
like, what was the purpose of it?
Okay, so looking back on it from what we now know, there was the cave collapsed, and a woman escaped with her child, and she was trying to protect her child, and she was poisoned while trying to protect her child, and she died out by the water, and someone else came and got it. With the season of perspective, and we're trying to put what Patty said into terms, I guess we could say that once this society of our cave collapsed, people are just trying to figure out how to maintain a family, and if a family is worth maintaining.
Yeah.
Because Patty talks a lot about that, too, about family being a crutch, a weakness, something that should be destroyed.
Yeah.
So maybe, like, taking this as a full, like, visual metaphor or allegory, like, the woman is the survivor's. After the cave woman is the survivors after the departure. The baby is like the idea of family and stability. And she's trying to protect it, but in trying to protect it, she dies. Does that sound okay?
I
just like sort of like trying to piece things together like I'm back in like college lit classes. So. I think it's significant that on his quest to kill Patty 3 different times, Kevin's given the opportunity to kill himself. And he doesn't. But he is given that opportunity, which he's been sort of suicidal in the past. So maybe it's saying something about Kevin that he's not going to not want feeling so suicidal these days.
I don't know. He's still crazy.
I think that he agrees with the guilty remnant sentiment. That's what Patty says to him, right? She says that assassins are assassins because something has been awoken inside of the assassin and they agree with it. And John Wilkes Booth fucking loved black people. Okay, if you say so, Patty. Do you think that Kevin agrees with him?
When I was thinking about that, I was thinking, like, I think he probably does. He just doesn't want to, like, admit it, that he does agree, a lot with the guilty remnants. When it comes to, like, attachment to people and stuff like that, that it's ridiculous to do at this point. Because, it died when the departure happened. And I think he can't attach to people really well. And the destroying of families, he's constantly fucking up his family as well. So I think he does kind of,
Patty's spinning some truth. If she is a projection of his subconscious, I'm very unclear. Okay, for the record, this could be purgatory. This could be some fever dream he has after this poison was injected in him. Maybe it wasn't a deadly poison. Maybe it gave him like an acid dream or some shit, who knows? But if in this world, if Patty is a projection of his subconscious somehow, and he has to kill her, then maybe he does have to kill her because he agrees with her ideology, because assassins kill the people they agree with. I don't know. This episode, more than any other so far, left me with more questions than answers. But one answer we did get is, I think people can come back from the dead. I think Kevin was probably like that bird, and he rose after 3 days.
That's crazy. That's interesting.
One of the things I love. One of the things I really liked about this. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ash.
No, I was talking about when they killed the bird in the damn hotel.
Yeah, was the bird? Could the bird have been Edie? That's because like Virgil was very concerned about the bird, and I was just like, and you know, Erica was out there burying birds, and I was just thinking like, if the bird dies, does that mean Edie's dead? Like, I mean, there are like more questions than there are answers. One of the things I did like though was how they like Trojan horse a spy thriller into this like mystical crazy ass episode. It was all a little by the books, but it was just neat that like all of a sudden Kevin adorned himself in spyware. That was the funniest thing all week of anything on any of the shows we watched this week, was when he was talking to Virgil, and Virgil's like, it's obvious, you're an international spy.
What? Look what you're wearing.
Because obviously anybody in a suit is an international assassin. Like, that's just the way it is.
Oh, man, it was so good. I'm actually kind of curious of what the different outcomes or the way things would have been different if he chose like a different outfit for himself, and the story would have changed, you know. Because his cop uniform, I think, was in there and some other stuff. So I'm
you know who else was in there, and I'm still gonna call it purgatory. You know who else was in there? Mary, Matt's wife, Mary was there.
Yeah.
So sorry, Matt. I think she's dead. I think she's dead, bro.
Yeah.
I think, like, her spirit has gone, and, you know, I think it's over. But we do know it's a boy now. Congratulations. The constant fire alarms were interesting, I thought. I thought that's why I mostly interpreted this as purgatory, because, okay, What else is fiery? Hell. In purgatory, you're in a state between, like, death and going to hell, and you're trying to work your way to get back to heaven or whatever. And, like, so Kevin is hearing these fire alarms all the time, and that signaled to me, like, oh, shit, he's in danger of going to hell. Which makes sense. He's a pretty shitty person. One thing I think we need to address before we get out of here, though, is the situation with the leftovers. Like, I've heard some people sort of bemoaning there's been a decline in viewership this season, and people wondering if there will be a next season. I feel strongly there will be, because this is not ABC, this is not CBS, NBC, or Fox. HBO could give a shit about viewership sometimes. If you can make the product relatively cheap, and more importantly, if you can get critical acclaim, which this season is getting and will get. Like, make no mistake, like, The Leftovers will be nominated for a few awards. And that's the number one thing HBO cares about. And as long as it is, I feel like they're going to give it a third season. HBO has money out of its ass. It will spend money all over the place. And the most important thing that HBO right now is building up their library in HBO Now to compete with Netflix and Amazon. So, of course, if they have a series that people like, they're going to give it more seasons to have more in their library. So, I don't think anybody should worry. I think we're safe. One more thing before we leave here, Ash. If you bury a bird in the woods and it comes out alive, you get your wish. What happens if you bury a human in the woods and he comes out alive? What do you get then?
A zombie? I don't fucking know.
He might be changed. Like, remember the dude who put the noose around his neck was like, "It's going to change you." I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe Kevin will be like Buffy. Maybe he won't come back right.
He came back wrong.
Yeah, like part demon or something. Anything, nothing is out of bounds on this show. 2% of the population vanished into thin air. Kevin rose from the dead, okay? Nothing is out of bounds. I don't know. I do know I'm fascinated to see what happens in these last couple of episodes, and the conflict between Kevin and John is inevitable. Like, I can't.
That damn
imprint. Yeah, and I feel like John. I won't be surprised if this season ends with John dying. Like, this could, John, I don't feel like John, if Edie is gone and Kevin is now the suspect, we know how John's going to react. Seeing how I think we just proved they're not going to kill off Kevin, I think John's in jeopardy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's in trouble. But Kevin's totally going to get his ass kicked first, though.
Yeah, he definitely, which is fine. Kevin's an expert in getting his ass. He's getting his ass kicked by, like, the random guy who tried to kill him in his hotel room for a little bit there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, apparently, Kevin's an international assassin, though. You don't want to just go around fucking with him. All right, so join us next week. Hopefully we will actually get a few answers to some of the myriad questions posed this week. We still have Fargo left up, so stay with us. Ash, what did you feel? How did you feel about what did the awkwardly named? Did you do this? No, you did it. What did you think?
That's hilarious. But it was a great episode. I really liked it.
It was.
It was really good.
I agree. Okay, let's start with a discussion of Simone. Rest in peace, Simone. I liked you. When we first met Simone, how did she come across to you, like, in the first episode or two?
Not necessarily, it seemed, but she, well, clearly, you know, a smartass, you know, who trying to rebel against her father.
Rebellious, I would say maybe a thrill seeker. Like, she seemed like she was up to something, and maybe she was just trying to have a good time, and she was, you know, she liked to smoke pot and hang out with dangerous dudes. By the end of Simone, I felt that she was a victim. You know, it is implied that Dodd may have sexually abused her. He certainly physically and emotionally did. Like, by the end, I didn't feel like this was a girl, like, trying to be a thrill seeker and looking for fun. Like, I felt like this was a desperate person who was sort of been fucked up by what their father did to them.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very sympathetic towards her.
That scene with Simone is a perfect example to me of how the show can use setting as a character. Like, the bare trees and the endless miles of snow, it just, like, reinforces the hopelessness and despair of that situation. Even more than, like, the look on Bear's face. The music is also great in that scene, but probably the most fascinating thing was, like, after Bear killed her, in the split screen, it's been used all year, constantly, and in this episode, too. But instead of it showing two different characters, there was just a black line down the string that isn't initially showing two things at once at all. It's dividing Bear from, like, a material object that he is pounding on. And to me, it's just, like, emphasizing his impotence. Like, how little his rage matters. Like, that's the message. I mean, it was one of the more interesting things, because for a show that uses that black line all the time, that black line was put up there, but there was nowhere else, nothing else to see. It was just a black line in the middle of the screen. And I thought that was an interesting thing. Mike Milligan met The Undertaker. I was so disappointed that there was not like a big bell toll and Mark Caraway coming out with like his druids. Like, how much better would that Undertaker have been?
Oh my gosh, that would have been so good. I
honestly thought it was going to be a young Lauren Malvo. And for you and for anybody who didn't like watch season one, Lauren Malvo was the Billy Bob Thornton's character, who was almost this he was a character very much like Javier Bardem's in No Country for Old Men. He was just like a force of nature that killed everyone and everything in his path. And I thought that we were going to meet, like, a young version of him. But no, we just met a dude, Mike Milligan, slit throat in, like, 5 seconds. It was like,
yeah.
It really subverted the hype. It was like, okay, we're getting there. Here comes the guy, the Undertaker. He's going to end all this shit. Mike Milligan kills him instantly. Bam.
Like, boom.
And the visual, it was. And the visual of the blood on Mike's hand as he's, like, hesitating for the phone. It's such a simple metaphor. Obviously, he's got blood on his hands. It's rich and visual and vivid. I don't know. It was really, I thought it was like a really pretty scene in a way, which is a weird thing to say about a triple murder. So, if you're keeping score at home, I will not help Crack Horse, and I think triple murders are pretty. In a weird place. Go ahead.
I actually thought the Undertaker was like a decoy, the guy that he killed, because I thought the Undertaker was gonna like be the one on the phone or something like that.
Yeah,
that's what I thought at first.
What about Bear not having any fucking interest in getting Dodd back?
I don't blame him.
I mean, he's going like full on like fuck the family though. Kills Simone, tries to basically is getting Dodd killed. I mean. What's funny is this was like a story about the small time family values, whatever those values might be, versus the big syndicate. And like what's ending the story basically is like one of the family members being like, "Nah, fuck you guys, I'm sick of this shit."
He's so over that. He's so over that family at this point.
Yeah,
I don't blame him because of his son, man. His son was everything.
I mean, one thing I love about Fargo is it has very full characters, but there also, like, has room for these archetypes, like the Kitchen Brothers. The Kitchen Brothers aren't full, like, real thought-out characters, but they exist around people who are, and it further informs them. I want to say this. The medium of film is set apart not because of the stories it can tell. Okay, it can tell any story that can be told in a film, or with film, can be told in literature, or theater, or graphic novels, or poetry. It's set apart by the way it tells stories. And what Fargo does is so clever. It's the way it frames its shots, the way it uses music, and the way it acknowledges what an audience is familiar with. It subverts that expectation. Like, in Simone's death, we know it's coming. They know we know it's coming. It doesn't try to use sleight of hand or trickery. It just shows us, albeit extremely well, it just shows us what's going to happen. And in the counter scene, like, we all know what's coming with the Undertaker. The Undertaker's going to come, and he's going to fucking clean house, and, like, we know what's coming. Oops, no you don't. It shows you things in a way that makes you anticipate exactly what it wants you to anticipate. It's just very familiar with our viewership. I don't know. I think it's very clever.
I agree.
I thought the opening scene was pretty impactful, like showing how much has been lost in the war.
Yeah.
Like all the Gerharts are dying. Kansas City is reeling. Like nobody wins a war. Like somebody just loses it less. I mean, an individual determination does not win wars. It does not matter how much that Indian is tracking people. It does not matter, like, how badass Floyd is. Like, the people with the money and the guns are going to win. It's just...
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you feel about the feminism Of Fargo. I just want to have a brief conversation about that before we do anything.
I like the way, it's being handled, especially, considering the decade, it's after the 60s, and there's so much, not freedom, but people shine, women were trying to, come up in the world and, be their own person, so, you have Floyd, who's this very powerful woman, and it shows that she can run this family. She can if, her idiot son, wasn't so sexist, it was a sexist prick. But she does it, she probably do it better than her husband. And you have Peggy, who pretty much run, kind of, trying to come up in the world as well. And yeah, Simone, I actually like the women, female characters on the show and the way it's being, I think it's well done.
I think it's done perfectly, and here's why I think that. Feminism is inherently the belief that men and women are equals. And this isn't a show where the men are all buffoons and the women are brilliant, like Jessica Jones. That's not feminism, really. That's its own thing. This is not a show where the female characters are inept and the men have to do all the work. This is a show where some women are inept and some men are inept. And some women are brilliant, and some men are brilliant. Like, and it accurately portrays the politics of it of its time, where women have a harder time getting ahead, and but it doesn't belittle them anyway. And like the state of television is such right now that this is a really simple achievement on the scale of things Fargo does well. Like portraying men and women as like being intellectual and emotional equals is pretty simple. But it's almost revelatory because there are so many shows that do not do this. And like, so I feel like it should be called attention when someone does. Do you have any more thoughts about did you do this? No, you did it. Yeah. I said it like really fast because it's a mouthful.
Oh, the scenes with Bear and Simone, I just really loved the way it was done, the conversations, the acting, I thought
Yeah.
was amazing. Yeah.
Did you watch
And
The
also
Sopranos,
Floyd felt.
Ash?
No, I didn't watch
Okay. There's a
it.
scene. Spoiler alert for anybody who like I think it's been like 15 years, so I should be okay. But anybody who is planning to watch The Sopranos in the future, don't listen. Like, just go ahead and turn it off. We're almost done anyway. Is very reminiscent of Adriana, a beloved character on The Sopranos, is taken into the woods after it's found out that she's an informant, a government informant, and she's killed. And like, I don't know anybody who could have possibly watched The Sopranos who that didn't come to mind because it was just very reminiscent. Including the point where like she realized it was going to happen and she's begging and pleading and there's nothing. What? Who is the actor or actress of the week, Ash?
I'm gonna go with that's I can't think of the name of it. That's that played Patty.
And Dowd.
Huh?
And Dowd. And Dowd. Yes. I was informing you. Yeah, I think she was great. I'm gonna go with Tajiri Henson just because I think And Dowd was absolutely fantastic. I'm gonna go with Henson because I think what she has to do to pull that show together is more valuable to Empire than even as great as And Dowd is, what she brings to the leftovers. If that was an average performance, it would still be really interesting. If Tajiri Henson was giving an average performance, it might be a fucking mess. So, I'll
That's
go
true.
first with my scene of the week though, and it is Ann Dowd and Patty in the well with Kevin, and telling him about Jeopardy, and just like humanizing herself so much that by the end of it, like this fucking troll, this monster, we are sad to see her die. Like we are sad that he has to kill her again. We had to kill. Kevin had to kill the cult leader Patty, then he had to kill the little girl Patty, then he had to kill like the actual person Patty. What was your favorite scene of the week?
I'm gonna go with Baron Samoan in the woods. I thought that was it was a
that
very
sounds like
very
a weird
well
joke.
Done thing.
Baron Samoan in the woods.
It does.
That's what they should have
but
named
yeah,
the episode.
So you got Bear, you got a bear in the in the woods. Oh, that's funny. But no, yeah, it was beautifully shot. It was very well acted. I just absolutely loved that scene.
My favorite, best episode of the week. It should have been called "Does a Bear Shoot in the Woods?" By the way, that was just that should be the name. I'm gonna go with Fargo though. As much as I loved International Assassin, I'm gonna go with "Did You Do This?" No, you did it. It because as much as I love The Leftovers, some of that, you know, is some of the things that are happening there are a little cliched, and some of it's just frustrating because I don't know what the fuck is happening. And Fargo is just so clean and clear and concise and well done. And I'm just, okay, Fargo, you win.
Okay, I'm going to go with The Leftovers, actually.
Okay.
I thought it was very confusing and frustrating, but that's what I loved about it because I didn't know what the fuck was going on. But it was so well done, and the symbolism throughout the whole episode with different things, I thought it was really well done.
Yeah.
Even though it's confusing as hell.
It very much is. Ash, do you want to get on your soapbox? I believe there was a season finale.
No, that's next week.
Damn it! The show never ends!
That's Sunday. Yeah, it's this Sunday, the mid-season finale.
So only one more time this year, like my Facebook and Twitter feeds have to blow up about it. Great. All right.
Yep.
Okay.
This episode, it was not necessarily filler. It was more like setting up to for the finale. The wall by the end of the episode, the wall is finally coming down. So it's about to be like whole bunch of fucking zombies just walking around in this whole fucking town while they're trapped in their homes, and I'm ready for some people to die. But Glenn's alive. I'm happy for that shit. We had to wait like 4 episodes to find out, but yeah, we finally found out that he did not die, and now he's they paired him up with a character, a teenage girl. The character is Enid, and
is he going?
Like
is he going to take her in the woods and shoot her? He has, yeah. Otherwise, it's just gonna be a letdown.
No, they try to they are interesting dynamic because Glenn is has always been pretty much this optimistic guy. Where you got this character Enid, she's just like the world's trying to die, why don't we just let it, So and they have to work together because he wants to take her back home, but she doesn't want to go, and now they have to work together because he needs to get back home to his wife, but it's surrounded by fucking it is a fucked up moment because right before the wall came down, like this is when Glenn is sending pretty much a signal to let them know that he's alive and he made it. But like so everyone's happy, like, okay, Glenn's alive, everything's okay, and then right as soon as that happened, the fucking wall comes down. So yeah, it's gonna be some people dying next time, hopefully next episode. Hope it's not a letdown.
Yeah, it'll be really disappointing if there are no triple murders, okay?
Yeah.
Generally speaking, that's how I feel about television. I'm just going to get, speaking of is he dead, is he not dead, mysteries, I'm going to give a shout out to Game of Thrones. Thank you for just going ahead and getting that shit out of the way, because we all knew Jon Snow wasn't dead. Like, there's way too fucking much invested in that character. He is the only character on the wall anyone cares about. Like, and seeing how the entire next season should be focused around the wall, like, we all knew Jon Snow was not dead. Plus, there's way too much evidence that, okay, here's a little history, a little fact. When the television writers took over, or when they were auditioning, basically, to adapt the series, the author of the books, help me out with his name, George R. Martin. George R. Martin asked the television writers, who is Jon Snow's parents? What was the first thing he asks them? Like, you don't ask that about a character if like, he's not a, you know, like, the central character of your story. So, anyway, the HBO released a poster with Jon Snow's face on it for season 6.
Yeah.
So, Jon Snow's not dead, everybody. You can all breathe easy. that was it.
Walt Dead was cruel with us, because we had to wait, like, 4 episodes, but, like, they took the actor's name out of the opening credits.
Oh, that's fucking mean.
That was terrible.
Well, I mean, Game of Thrones, people who really thought Jon Snow was dead for the last, like, 4 or 5 months, so, I mean, that's arguably even worse.
Yeah.
But anyway, guys, thank you for listening. Check out our other podcast. It's called Your Childhood Trauma. We talk about all things Buffy the Vampire Slayer related, and we walk through like 3 a week. Give us a like, a comment, a share. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Podomatic. Thank you for listening. I'm John.
And I'm Ash.
And we're out.